Hi everyone, it's me, Sandy Cruz of Sandy K Nutrition, Health and Lifestyle Queen. For years now, I've been bringing to you conversations about wellness from experts from all over the world. Whether it be suggestions in how you can age better, biohacking, alternative wellness, these are conversations to help you live your best life. I want to live a long, healthy, and vibrant life. Never mind all those stigmas that as we reach midlife and beyond, we're just going to shrivel up and die with some horrible disease. Always remember, balanced living works. I really look forward to this season. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, Health and Lifestyle Queen. Today, I have a special episode all about inflammation. And this is with Bob Messerschmidt of CoreHealth.com. And Core is spelt without the E at the end. You'll see it in my podcast notes, but it's CoreHealth.com. And we talk all about how to measure inflammation. And what does inflammation mean in the body? Now, Bob has a long and interesting history where he's actually been in the health tech industry for a very long time. This even goes back to his workings with Steve Jobs. Yeah, this is going to be an amazing interview where you're going to really get the technology side of understanding inflammation and how to measure it and what all of these numbers mean on your blood work. This is a really important interview. And we're going to talk about this new way to measure at home. So I suggest you go to CoreHealth.com. Remember, that's Core without the E at the end of Core. CoreHealth.com and get on the wait list. This is going to be an affordable at-home way that you can measure microinflammation. And some might say inflammation is really the beginnings, microinflammation is the beginnings of every single disease. Oh yeah, this is going to be big, you guys. Definitely go follow me on all my socials. It's Sandy K Nutrition anywhere and everywhere. You can watch the entire interview on YouTube, Sandy K Nutrition. You'll be able to see the device that Bob has created and watch it there. And definitely share this interview with anyone who might benefit. It's Sandy K Nutrition on Instagram, Facebook, private Facebook group. I'm on TikTok. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Twitter. Just look for Sandy K Nutrition anywhere and everywhere. And now let's cut on through to this amazing interview with Bob Messerschmidt of Core Health. And by the way, everything will be in the show notes if you need to get the spelling and the links. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sandy K Nutrition, Health and Lifestyle Queen. Today with me, I have a special guest. His name is Bob Messerschmidt. And I got it right. I said it right. I'm so happy. So following decades of obesity and associated metabolic health issues, Bob regained a healthier weight and reclaimed his metabolic health after he realized that the core driver was microinflammation. He founded Core Health, and that's C-O-R, not C-O-R-E, in case if you're just listening.
Thank you.
He founded Core Health to enable everyone to better understand their microinflammation so that they too have the best opportunity to manage their best health. Now, Bob is a Williams Wright Award recipient for his contribution to industrial spectroscopy. Did I say that right, Bob?
That's perfect.
Okay, yes. Good. Bob had two successful exits before he cold emailed Steve Jobs about his third company. Steve immediately called him and soon after acquired the company. Bob then went on to work directly with Steve and others for years. Steve's vision for consumer devices in the future of health heavily influenced Bob. And aside from Core, Bob is most proud of his contribution to the Apple Watch. And so you're a tech guy, Bob. You're a tech guy. I love it. So today we are going to be discussing inflammation, and a key term that so many are using now is inflammaging. And you guys all know I'm all about aging better and figuring that out. And today we're going to talk about this huge topic. So welcome, Bob. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and nice to be chatting.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear how you got into this because you're a tech guy, actually, right? Am I right?
I'm a tech guy from way back. I was that Williams Wright Award that you mentioned is related to my training was in spectroscopy, and spectroscopy just means measuring things with light. So my background is optics and spectroscopy, and then more recently got involved in digital health because of my expertise in optics and spectroscopy. So that's been the thread through my career is measuring things that are not so difficult to measure and quantify using optics and light and spectroscopy. And of course, blood is one of those things. So, doing blood measurements using optics and spectroscopy has been a thread through my career.
Wow. And I mean, Steve Jobs, like that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it was 2008 and I had a startup, it was called Rare Light, and I had developed some technology and I was looking to fundraise. I wasn't looking to be acquired, but I've been an Apple fanboy since way back. Probably, I think I got a Macintosh. Actually, my boss bought a Macintosh in 1984 when the Macintosh first came out. I'm dating myself.
I was just going to say, Bob, don't date yourself.
Anyway, I got to use that. And I've always been a Macintosh, Apple fan. I thought for various reasons, health reasons and, sort of things that were out there in the sphere, that Steve would be interested in, the technology that I was developing. And I didn't expect him to be so interested that, he said, well, the only way this makes sense for us is if we own it.
Yeah.
And, he said, tell me how much you want.
Wow.
Anyway, so that was 2008, I then started working at Apple as a platform architect, which I don't know, in the Apple parlance, a platform can mean is basically a device, like a device category. So an iPad is a platform, iPhone is a platform, but MacBook Air and MacBook Pro are two different platforms. So anyway, that's how they divide up platforms. And platform architecture just means really, in the Apple parlance, it just means early ideation. It's a little bit like people I think are more familiar with what Google X does or did. So it's really, there are all these tiger teams at Apple led usually by one expert. They have some area of expertise and they're trying to develop and ideate new technologies that might go in a future platform, of one kind or another. In addition to the platform technology that I brought that came to Apple through the acquisition, while I was there, I was also asked to get involved with the Apple Watch, which was not the Apple Watch yet. It was just a project. There was a lot of argument at Apple about whether it should even have health measuring technology in it. A lot of people at Apple in these early stages just really thought it was a, not just, but they believed that it should purely be a communication device. So as a way of teleporting your critical, you know, information that you might normally have to pull your phone out of your pocket to, you know, to get these small bits of information. So there was definitely a camp at Apple that felt that it should purely remain that. It should purely be a communication device. But there's another camp at Apple that believed that was going to be the ultimate device. You know, you got to think back to 2010 and what the digital health wearables space looked like at that point. There wasn't much.
No.
There was a Fitbit that it was you clipped it onto your belt or onto your pocket of your pants.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was only slightly after people were trying out things like devices that you had to attach to the laces of your shoes, you know, to track your steps and so forth. So it was very early days, and there were one or two watch form factor devices. I think the Basis watch, if you remember that, was one of the earliest sensor based technologies. That company was eventually acquired by Intel.
Mm-hmm.
But the people at Apple who were interested in it being a health device, they found me somehow, and they said, "What could you do? What sort of sensors would you want to put in a watch if you had something on somebody's wrist?" And so, I and my team got together, and we got proof of concept on, I think, six different sensor technologies that we felt could eventually go in a watch form factor. So three of them have already launched at various times in the Apple Watch. When it launched, the very first version of the Apple Watch had a PPG sensor. PPG is photoplethysmography. So mm-hmm. it's basically measuring blood pulses. And, you know, you can see these sensors on the back of an Apple Watch.
Right, right.
They were there from the very beginning. So PPG is essentially measuring heart rate, and you can do other things with it too. But an offshoot of PPG would be pulse oximetry.
Okay. Yeah.
But that came later.
Yes.
So there was PPG. The second one that I and my team ideated and did proof of concept on was EKG, or some people say ECG, electrocardiogram. And for that, you have to complete a circuit. So you have to use your other hand to touch the digital crown, as it's called. And then you see an electrical waveform, which is your heart electrical impulses.
Okay.
And then the third one that's already been launched, I can only talk about ones that have been launched, obviously. The third one that launched was a temperature sensor.
Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, there's a pulse oximeter in there now, which, you know, is the same basic technology. And my team demonstrated these technologies, and that allowed that camp at Apple to win that argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was clear at that point that there had to be health functionality in the watch. This was really going to be a thing. People are really going to be able to improve their lives by tracking.
Yes.
And that, you know, I think you look at it now and that's obvious, right? But
very.
It was not obvious in 2010. And so I feel, yeah, pretty proud of my contributions there.
You should be. You should be, Bob.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool.
Well, and it's yeah, like you jumped in pretty early in the whole merging health with technology. And
yes.
This is the wave. Like, you know, it's kind of funny because I'm totally like a little bit of that creative side, a little bit of that woo side, a little bit of that science side. But I love technology. And if you give me something that's going to give me data and it's going to be accurate, I get so excited to talk about it because to me, this is revolutionary. This kind of technology could change the health of the world, right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And it's not just about numbers either. It's about putting the person in the center of that process. And it's, you know, a psychologist would refer to it as self-efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're empowered, and this is really the essence of Steve Jobs's vision of why, really, he thought about it first in terms of the iPhone, which launched in 2007. So that was a few years before I joined Apple. But he thought once you have a device which with that much bandwidth and that much computing power in your pocket, you're going to be able to take charge of a lot of these functions that you had to give the authority over to other people in the past. So mm-hmm. you had to let your doctor be the expert, and of course the doctors have a role, obviously, but people being empowered to take control of their own health is essential.
I think you're talking to one of the biggest advocates of exactly
that. Yeah, you're I'm preaching to the choir.
You are, because I think that, you know, I will never dismiss the importance of Western medicine. Never.
Of course.
Never.
Of course.
They have a place.
My brother's a heart surgeon, so I can't.
There you go. There you go. No, but I will never dismiss the role of Western medicine, actually, especially heart surgeons. Like, I mean, they truly save lives, literally.
Totally.
Right?
Totally. Yeah.
So I will never dismiss that, but let's face facts. I hear this from people from all over the world. Doctors are overtaxed. Costs are high. Here, specifically in Canada, there are limitations on how much they can do, how much blood work they can run under a socialized healthcare system. And I don't think I'll get in trouble for saying that. These are just the facts. And so I'm not dismissing the importance of doctors. I'm just saying we need more. We need more. And we need to take accountability, because I'm going to say this. Yeah. And I'm writing something right now, Bob. And one of the lines that I said is, I'm going to shout this from the rooftop. Nobody, I don't care how much medical training you have, nobody knows your body better than you do. If you're in touch with what's going on, that is.
Yeah.
I mean, if there are other things involved, like, you know, other factors, that's a different story. But somebody like me, there's no doctor that knows me better than me. Period.
Right. And there seems to be quite a lot of difference from individual to individual in terms of what will work and what won't work. And so there's no other way to deal with that, because medicine is really only going to be about the population averages.
Correct.
It's what it's really best at. And, individual responses, individual differences. I am a total believer that tracking is the future, and it's early days, I think, for tracking and for digital health. I think we're 2010 was really early.
Yeah, no kidding.
2023 is still early. I think the future is really bright for those of us in this space.
So you're saying you're just getting going.
Just getting going.
That's right. I like it. So, and you know, you did say something just there that I couldn't agree with more, again, is how we are all so bio-individual. I say this all the time. So we're going to start getting into inflammation, but I mean, the facts are the facts. What may cause inflammation in my body may not for you, Bob.
Yeah.
That's a fact, right?
It's a very complex process, so it's not surprising, really.
Yes. So let's get into what exactly inflammation is and why should we really care so much?
Inflammation in a technical sense is your body's response to an assault. So you don't want your body to be assaulted, But, you know, people often point out that inflammation can be good and inflammation can be bad. So the reason inflammation exists is because bad things happen to your body. You get injured. And if you're injured, you need the inflammatory response. And there's a whole cascade of events that occur because your body is going to try to heal itself against that assault. So it might be a disease. It might be a microbe, you know, a virus or a bacterial infection. It might be, you know, a physical assault on your body, you know, a cut, a broken limb, something like that. Or pulled muscle even. And, you know, your body is, has the ability to respond to that with an inflammatory response. So that's what is referred to as acute inflammation. So yeah. Acute in this sense is just meaning that it's, in response to an event, right? It's a, sort of a, I always think of it more as a temporal difference between acute and chronic. So, you know, an acute assault, acute inflammation is something that is event-driven and it's resolvable. It's not long-standing.
Meaning, sorry, Bob. So your own body can kind of deal with it, like you said. If it's an acute inflammatory process, like you know, I bump my arm on the door over there and I get a big purple bruise. Well, my body is going to deal with that. And it's actually very healthy because your own body's going to call in the troops and say, let's go and fix that, whatever Sandy did to her elbow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going out on a limb if I say that, you know, 90% of the stuff, maybe 99% of the stuff that happens to your body is going to fix on its own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's always doing that.
Yeah.
And, so there are markers of that, right? So, you know, the goal of laboratory medicine is to try to evaluate what your body is doing and, you know, trying to understand if there is a problem. So laboratory medicine has come to measure all these different things in blood that are markers of inflammation. And so, and these markers have been around in many cases for hundreds of years. So, you know, there's always been a need to measure the inflammatory response using various markers. And of course, blood is the gold standard in that. So, you know, there are non-blood markers that we can use. Kind of blood is where it's at.
Yeah. Well, what would be the non-blood markers?
Well, I'm thinking more like scores, so like surveys and scores, pain scores and things like that.
Okay, yeah. So what are these markers? Because there's two big ones, right? Do you want to go through that, Bob?
Sure, yeah. So that has changed over the last 100 years. If we were sitting here 100 years ago talking on our Zoom call, we would be talking about erythrocyte sedimentation rate as the primary indicator of inflammation. And it's a very long-standing test. And that is the test that we're using in the core reader. So just because it's been around for a long time does not mean it's outmoded in any way. In more recent years, the next test that came along, the next marker of inflammation that came along was fibrinogen. And then more recently, CRP, C-reactive protein, became a marker of inflammation. So they all have different pluses. They all have different minuses. There are other minor markers as well. So they create a tapestry of different ways that you can understand inflammation. CRP is the most recent. CRP is short for C-reactive protein. And that's a protein that's produced in the liver. And what it is really it's I would describe it as a molecular beacon. Your body produces, your liver produces C-reactive protein whenever there's inflammation. So and then C-reactive protein circulates in your blood system and goes to the place where it identifies inflammation occurring. And it attaches itself. And then there's a whole cascade of other proteins called cytokines. Mm-hmm. Cytokines come along and try to repair that that inflammation. That CRP is just waving its hand and saying, okay, here it is. Cytokines, come and fix it.
Okay.
Fibrinogen is another.
Okay, protein. Bob, can I go back? Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Because there's also high sensitivity CRP. That's more for the heart inflammation, like that would indicate issues with heart health, right?
So it's actually, high sensitivity, HSCRP.
Yeah.
It's the same marker. So it's just CRP. So
I'm confused because I thought there were two different blood tests. One was CRP only and one was high sensitivity CRP that can detect heart issues more. No?
So it's the same. They're both detected. There are two different tests and you have to order them differently if you're ordering a lab test. But they're both measuring the same thing. They're both measuring CRP. The HSCRP uses a different assay.
Okay.
So it's a different chemical means of measuring the CRP that moves the sensitivity range down. So it can detect the CRP test will only report values greater than, I think it's 1 mg/L or maybe even 3 mg/L. The high sensitivity CRP test is reporting CRP levels all the way down to usually 0.4 mg/L, sometimes 0.8, depending on the laboratory that you're using to do it. So all they've done with the HSCRP test is they've said, okay, we have a new way of measuring CRP, a different chemical means in the laboratory, and we can measure lower levels of CRP this way.
So it's just like exactly what it says, high sensitivity. So it's a little more sensitive, right?
And so get ready for this. Nobody's heard about this yet, and it doesn't exist in the U.S. or Canada, I believe, doesn't have this yet. But next year or the year after, what you'll be ordering for your patients is WRCRP.
Okay.
So wide-ranging CRP. So wide range CRP is yet another new laboratory test, and it covers the range of both CRP and HSCRP. So wide range CRP is a single test that gives you the full range of both.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. It's an interesting industry. Laboratory testing is. Each of those things has a different reimbursement code also. So, and they all have different patents that cover them, right? So there are, you know, the flow of capital is different the marketing budgets are different between those three markers. So, the goal in laboratory medicine is to create a new biomarker, get it approved, and then, you know, basically show how good it is, and then go to the funding, the reimbursement agencies, and say, okay, we want a reimbursement code for this new test, and this is why we want that reimbursement dollar amount to be as high as possible. I don't yet know what the reimbursement amount of money is for. You know, in the U.S., it's CMS, the federal agency that gives all the reimbursement codes. So what that means is basically how much is the laboratory going to be compensated if the patient is either on Medicare or is self-insured? Mm. That's how much the laboratory can charge for that test. It's all very, I've gone down a little bit of a rabbit hole here. But suffice it to say that CRP, high sensitivity CRP, and wide-ranging CRP are all just measuring CRP.
Okay. Okay. Fair.
They just have different ranges.
Fair. This is good information. Now, yeah. Fibrinogen, you're going to go on into right? Like, yeah. I actually don't know a lot about that one.
It's another test. It's fibrinogen is produced in your liver as well. It's another protein that's produced in your liver. And it's also been shown in longitudinal studies to not only correlate with inflammation. So all of these that we're talking about, CRP, fibrinogen, ESR, they all correlate with inflammation, and they all have correlate with increased morbidity and mortality. They all are indicative of, you don't want this, right? This is bad. And yeah.
Although, you know, it's interesting because you can have those markers go up temporarily too. Like I remember last year, I went and did a blood test that had ESR in it, and I didn't real, and I wasn't, I forget why she was, I know why. Yes. It was for chronic wrist pain. Okay. Now I remember. Okay. So my doctor wanted to see if there was any kind of inflammation. She was obviously checking to see if this is more systemic or just going on here. And yeah. I went and did the blood work when I had a cold, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. I had a cold and I did the blood work and I was like, oh, crap. Like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, wait a minute. I do know that this can go up temporarily when you have a virus, too. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, my God, I've got an autoimmune condition or anything, right? So we need to understand that it can go up and down, right?
It can go up and down, absolutely. And I don't know whether you did CRP at the same time.
I did. But, I did.
Yes. That also went up, probably.
Yep. Both of them did.
Yeah, both of them did. And so there's a high degree of overlap between CRP and ESR. They are mostly overlapped. So you'll mostly get the same answer or, using CRP or ESR for the most part. And there are these edge cases where it's going to be different.
So here's the big question. Why would someone or a doctor or, you know, if you want to measure it yourself, why choose ESR over CRP? Because ESR is also a protein, right?
Yeah.
Also in the liver?
Also in the liver. ESR is not a, sorry, CRP is a protein.
Okay.
Yes, ESR is not a protein. It's not measuring a molecule itself. What it's doing is it's measuring the rate of sedimentation. So ESR stands for erythrocyte sedimentation rate. So erythrocyte is your red blood cells.
Yeah.
And what was observed, this is 200 years ago, it was observed that if you draw blood from a person and anticoagulate it, so you have to add some stuff to cause the blood not to clot, and you put it in a vertical glass tube and just watch it, the red cells are going to start separating from the plasma.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to start falling towards the bottom of that glass tube. And somebody, the person who was the inventor of ESR as an important number, that person observed that It was different from person to person, and they were able to correlate it with an inflammatory response.
Mm.
So the faster that your blood cells sediment, that means you have more inflammation.
Mm.
Okay. So it's a very simple test. It's not measuring it's not measuring a molecule that's circulating in your blood, and it's not secreted by the liver, but it's measuring, I would say in a way, it's a more direct measure of inflammation. So you don't have to go through this thunking layer of detecting an intermediate molecule. You're really saying, what's the current condition in your blood? What's the current condition of the amount of inflammation in your blood? It's really a fairly direct test of that. So I've come to really like it, and as an inflammatory marker, that combined with the fact that I was able to, so I am a technologist, as you pointed out, I was able to realize that I could measure ESR more easily in some ways, and probably most importantly, more inexpensively in a home device than I could measure CRP. So would I, you know, if I could measure CRP in a home device, you know, very inexpensively, I'd probably want to do both. A lot of clinicians use one as a confirmation of the other. So, you know, if you have a situation of your wrist pain, your doctor might measure one and then the other. It sounds like your doctor measured both at the same time. A lot of physicians do that too. There's no, it's kind of like everybody has their own way of doing it. But I've talked to many physicians who use one as confirmatory of the other. So CRP is high, let's see if ESR is also high. Or if ESR is high, let's see if CRP is also high. And then they make their treatment decision based on both things together. But things are a little different in a tracking sense. So in any one given individual, if you're trying to look at your change day to day or week to week over time, you can use just one of those markers. And because they have such a high degree of overlap, they're going to give you the same information. You know, to a large extent. So really for me, it came down to what can I, you know, this is probably Steve Jobs, you know, lessons, but how can I bring it to more people? And how can I use it as a way to engage people in this self-efficacy more readily? Well, getting the cost low is one thing. And, you know, so I can do that, with ESR more easily for various reasons.
I love this. You know, I do. Because I think that exactly what you said. So it's not necessarily about the one shot blood work that we're doing. It's about the trend. It's about, trend. So I know, and funny thing is, of course, my doctor called me in. She's like, you know, your CRP was high, your ESR. And I'm like, yeah, doc, I had a cold. I made a mistake. And she's like, oh, okay. Like, I didn't even think about it. And I should have, because this is why the one shot blood work. It's not going to suffice if you're really trying to make and take strides in improving your health. So
Let me say another thing about, if we were in a world before CRP existed, the king of the roost, the king of the road was fibrinogen. So your doctor pre-CRP would always, for inflammation, was measuring either ESR or fibrinogen. CRP came along and, you know, it's really measuring very much the same. It's giving you the same answer as fibrinogen. I have a friend and colleague at Stanford Medical School, and he says that CRP really just had a better PR agent. That fibrinogen is really the same test. And fibrinogen goes up and down as inflammation in your body goes up and down. Now, what is ESR measuring? So in any one individual, if you take out person-to-person differences for a moment, the changes that you're going to see in your ESR day-to-day really reduces to changes in fibrinogen in your blood. So the thing that's going to most impact the amount, the speed at which your blood is sedimenting is the fibrinogen is an abundant protein in the plasma of blood. And so it's controlling the way your red cells are agglomerating to each other and the viscosity of the plasma and the rate at which the cells are falling through that plasma. So ESR in any one individual really reduces to a fibrinogen measurement. And it's highly correlated with fibrinogen. So, anyway, it's a, it's ESR has been a little bit out of mind, I think, for people, but it's a really good marker of inflammation. So I think it's going to help a lot of people. And like I say, we can introduce it at a lower cost.
So let's get into why. So there's a lot. We'll just touch base, just very maybe high level, on why we want to check inflammation that doesn't resolve itself. Like, what are the diseases? And I am going to preface this by saying we are not giving medical advice here at all. This is just a conversation in educating yourself. And if you do have issues, go see your own practitioner, because we're not giving you advice here. We're just talking to you and educating you on how you can actually have a hand in being proactive when you do have some issues. And then you're going to go and see your practitioner. So I just wanted to preface it with the disclaimer, because chronic inflammation is a whole other ballgame when it never comes down, right?
Yeah. I was just going to say that, we need to preface inflammation with either the word chronic or the prefix micro. People say micro inflammation. Also, or silent inflammation is another thing that I'm starting to see.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a completely different way of thinking than a disease state. So it is a disease state, but it's long standing. And there's a lot that you can do to control chronic inflammation that's not related to you don't necessarily need a drug. I mean, I should make my caveat also. I mean, some people are drugs for inflammatory conditions are of course fantastic, but what we're talking about here are, people having sort of low level chronic microinflammation without really being aware of it.
And that's the silent part, Bob, right?
Silent part, absolutely. And knowing that there are things that you can do lifestyle wise to impact that, I think is everything, right? I think it's everything to be able to.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I have to say, I actually just put out a post today, because in my post, I'm like, hey, if you want to know if all that partying you did at the cottage all summer long, maybe it's got a little more of an effect on you now that you're 52 than it did when you were 25. Right.
That's right.
This is what I'm talking about. It gets your head on straight, Bob, to say,
absolutely,
I got to get my stuff together and I have to, start eating. And this is why we're not talking about diagnosing a disease here.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So the idea or the thinking on chronic inflammation has changed. It's everywhere in the zeitgeist right now, right? People are tuned in to inflammation and things that they can do in their lifestyle to mitigate it. Largely because the evidence is really saying that microinflammation is underpinning and really is causative for almost all long-term chronic diseases. Mm-hmm. So not only autoimmune things, but also cardiovascular things metabolic things. All of the things that are ultimately cutting lives short, have at their underpinning this process of microinflammation. There's an interesting, it's kind of, this is out there in the literature for a long time, but I found this just truly amazing, this fact. So if you measure ESR, so ESR is a lab test, and your doctor can order it. Obviously your doctor ordered it for you. For any lab test, there's a reference range. Your doctor then will say, okay, how old are you? What's your gender? What is your ESR allowed to be given your demographics? And that trends up with time. So ESR has a has this strange characteristic that as you get older, your ESR is allowed to be higher. And the way that's been determined mm-hmm. is just, you know, they took a population of people and said, okay, what's the 95% chunk in the center? And we're going to call that normal. Those people are normal. We say they are normal. And, you know, the 5% that are outside of that, those are the ones that we have to treat, right?
Oh, but, God. Yeah, that's honestly, Bob, you hit a nerve here with me. This is where the whole conversation on inflammaging comes yes. in. It's that's like, right. And so I'm actually certified in functional lab testing. So I learned that a long time ago, that those lab ranges are not based on optimal. There's a big difference. And I want everyone, if you're going to get anything out of this, of course, first of all, you know, this is a pretty fantastic thing that we're talking about here. But if you're going to get anything out of this, just know that normal in lab ranges is not optimal.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Like just because exactly. I'm almost 54, pardon me, but that is such bullshit to say that I should be more inflamed than when I was 40. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. So, I mean, and it's not subtle. So with ESR, I'm as a 50 plus male, my ESR normal range, standard reference range, considered normal by the you know medical science, could be as high as 30.
Okay.
The number could be 30. But if I were, you know, in my 20s, they would want my ESR to be under 10. So why am I allowed to be 30 if someone in their 20s is only allowed to be at 10? Yes. The answer is it's just because of this, you know, the normal range that your hot button. They've done studies actually where they've looked at a population of people where they've excluded people from the data set who have overt inflammation and, you know, they're sick, right?
Yeah.
So they've taken sick people out.
Okay.
Look just at super healthy people. There's no age dependence in that group of people.
See?
Yeah. Yeah. There's none. Zero age dependence.
See?
So do I want my ESR to be 30? No, I want it to be sub 10.
Yeah.
And so that means that almost probably all of your listeners are out there running around with an ESR that is, in fact, elevated. And that gives us a lot of headroom to work to lower that by trying different strategies. For me, I happen to be a big fan of food-based strategies, so just superfoods. There are things that I can and did fix my inflammation through food means. So I was at one point not too long ago, I had an ESR of 40.
Wow!
Which, you know, that puts me at pretty great risk for cutting my life short, maybe by 15 years more, shorter than the average even. It's a huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, the reference range would allow me to be 30. Today I'm at 3.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Bob.
Yeah. Yeah. So, first thing wow. is having a very simple way to know what it is and then trying things and finding out things that are working. I choose to be at 3 and, that makes me feel good for my family and my high school age daughter, that I can have an inflammation score of 3.
That is so good to hear. So you're actually a real life case.
Absolutely. I am. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was dietary means that did it for me. It was, there are certain superfoods that work really well for me. They may not work for you.
Yeah.
But you can discover and you can try, just to be very specific, intermittent fasting was a fantastic tool for me. my numbers dropped tremendously when I started doing that. I lost weight during that process also. So they're kind of tightly correlated.
For sure.
But it still was, I was still lingering around an ESR of 7-ish, 7 or 8-ish. And I started trying various superfoods. And it turns out that tart cherries.
I've heard that. Yep.
So they're anti-inflammatory. We can go into mechanistically, what's going on with tart cherries, but a lot of people swear by tart cherry juice.
Mm-hmm.
And that took my number right down to, 3.
And it can also help you sleep, by the way, tart cherry juice.
Yes, absolutely.
So
I drink it at night, so for that reason.
So last year, I am an RHM, but I, last year, Bob, I actually got, I'm also premenopausal, menopausal, I don't even know at this point, but I'm kind of somewhere in between. And last year, I reached a 6.1 in my HbA1c. So I was pre-diabetic.
Yes, that's right.
There are other very important health metrics out there. At that time, I didn't check my ESR. So, I reversed that. I reversed pre-diabetes with diet, lifestyle. Not that I lived poorly, because I've been a nutritionist for a while. And, how humbling is that a nutritionist became a pre-diabetic?
Right.
And so this is the big caveat here. What works for one person may not work for the other. So what worked for me was I actually became a certified metabolic balance coach. So for me, eating with a 5-hour window of no food, no snacks.
Yes.
Reverse that for me.
That's interesting. We might have the same genotype.
That's
exactly what works for me, a 5-hour window.
Yes. So this is what we're talking about here, people. There are so many things you have the power within you to change before you become into that disease state or progress into a disease state that, let's face facts, it's harder to reverse. I'm not saying it's not possible. There's also movement. You have to find movement that works for you. You need to eat whole, real foods. And what that looks like is different for everybody, right? Yeah. And then there's sleep. Sleep.
Sleep is hugely important. I don't know. I got to say, I don't know whether seed oils are bad for me or not. They probably are. I see a lot of evidence out there.
Yeah.
But, sleep is hugely important. The thing that I've always liked to cook. And so I always find I can make things more healthily myself. I always feel like I'm not doing my body any favors. Even if I go out to a really nice restaurant,
I'm with you.
I don't think they're using really great ingredients. A lot of it comes down to the oils, because the anti-inflammatory oils or less inflammatory oils are more expensive.
Yes.
And they might not have the flavor profile that they're looking for. So, it's a challenge these days in the U.S. and I think Canada's the same way. I mean, you guys have your Tim Hortons, right?
I said a.
Tim Horton.
Yes, that is true. I mean, Canadians, we have fast food at every single corner as well, and
poutine.
The poutine. Yes, for sure. We've got it all as well. And really, I think, I have teen and young adult kids as well. I see the way they eat. They don't live with me. They're in university. I try and teach them, and I'm hoping that they learn sooner than later. And it's almost like a rebellious thing with a mom as a nutritionist that they'll throw it in my face that they ate McDonald's today. And I'm like, yeah. Okay, but that'll only get you so far. If you're, you know, over 40 and sure. still eating that way, then you've got some bigger issues. You better believe absolutely. You've got some inflammation going on. Now, let's shift gears. I want to find out more about this little hardware. Tell me. Yeah. Tell me about it. All right. Yeah, that's what it looks like. Perfect.
That's what it looks like. There's a second part to it. It looks like a little test tube, if you will.
Okay.
And we'll take the bottom off of this here, and you can probably see there's a little plastic tube inside.
Yeah.
And if you've ever done a glucose test strip
Tons.
In your home, you know, just with a lancet,
yeah.
you get a little tiny drop of blood, and you hold that up to this tube, and the blood sucks up into this tube by capillary action. You do that a few times, you get a tiny little drop, suck it up, do it again, suck it up. And, you know, once this tube is, you know, half full or so, you put the cap back on, I'm off camera.
Yeah.
Like so. And, drop it into the reader device.
Okay.
And then this device is hooked up to the Wi-Fi in your house. So, and then it's, what it's doing is it's sending the data to a cloud server. And that's where the data is processed. So 30 minutes later, you have an app, and you're going to be able to see what your result was.
Wow!
So it's really simple. Couldn't be simpler.
That is so cool. Now, what are we talking about cost wise? I know it's not out yet, and but people can get on your wait list like right now.
Yeah, the wait list is open. And,
okay.
So you can go to Core Health, C-O-R Health, and .com, and you'll see a link. I don't know, you're probably going to put a link in
I
your,
will. It'll be in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. You can sign up today. And we expect to be shipping these in December. We're going through a validation study right now. Just, you know, we need to... you know, validate all the data and make sure that everything is what we're expecting. And then we'll launch. We can't launch until we have that validation done. It's a FDA registered device.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. So it is approved.
Yeah. It isn't now, but it will
be. But it will be. And it's clinically valid data. It's not like.
Yeah.
Okay. That's important to note.
Yeah, so your doctor could, you know, if your doctor wanted ESR data, you know, that could be run on this device rather than sending the blood sample off to the lab.
Okay, I have another question.
Yeah.
So that's not the kind of thing you can share with somebody because the blood goes right like in the tube, like that has to be your own.
It does, yeah. If you have two people in your household who are both wanting to do ESR testing, you're absolutely correct. You need two of these.
Ah. Yeah,
it's linked to you. Yeah. That's just the reality of medical devices. They don't share nicely.
Yeah, because my information, my blood would be in there and then it would be mixing with my husband's blood and like that would be no good. No.
No, you would. I mean, you could do that. Obviously, you could. There's nothing to prevent you from putting somebody else's sample into your device, but then it's going to be in your data, right? So you don't want that in your tracking,
right? Because it's going to skew my trend.
You could delete that value, right? If you wanted to show your friend how it works,
okay.
You know, if your friend was over and you were having a anti-inflammatory lunch, you could do a sample. And put it in the device, and you know, once the reading comes in, then you could just delete it if you wanted to.
Yeah, anyone who wants to come to my place for a big anti-inflammatory party, come on down. No, but I do have a question though. With the actual measuring device, you would need different that pokes your finger. Like, what is that? That's what I mean.
Yeah. So these are disposable once you've done the test.
Okay, that's what I was. I'm like, you don't want to use the same needle.
No.
Okay. So gotcha.
This is single use, and then there's also the lancet, which is the thing that you prick your finger with. These are also single use.
Oh, okay.
You go click and it, you know, that gets a little tiny drop of blood.
Yeah.
And then you fill this tube.
Yeah.
And you throw both of these components out.
Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense. And then when it goes into the actual reader,
yeah,
it will not like taint what's in the reader because
it's
like
all contained.
There's
a cap on the bottom. So once you have this cap on, there's no blood on the outside.
Right. It doesn't go in the container.
Yep.
Okay.
No, it's sealed. This is sealed with there's a end cap on both ends of the blood container.
That is so cool, Bob. Now I have another question. We're almost at an hour, by the way. I mean, I feel like we could talk forever.
Time flies.
I know. What about other things? Do you think that this is just the beginning?
It's definitely just the beginning. So, you know, for me, the big mission is around engaging people in this process of self-efficacy, which that's a lot of syllables. So we've shortened it at core. We talk about self-health.
I like it.
Which basically just means self-efficacy. So it's taking control. And how can you take control if you don't know your data, right? So you need your data just like your physician needs data. I think something like 70 to 90% of all clinical decisions these days are made based on lab test results. You know, so it's the data, right, that's informing your physician. It should also be the data informing you, quite frankly, you know, about things that you're going to do in your lifestyle to improve your health. So that's the big mission for us is, so there might be other devices down the road, which I can't talk about, but, you know, there might be other devices down the road.
Okay.
It might even be, you know, wearables and things like that. There might be other clinical numbers that can be derived from the data that's already, you know, that you've already collected with your ESR data. Actually, this is a bit enticing and intriguing that, you know, if you, your data can be, we can provide some of that information retrospectively. If we validate a second marker out of your data, we can provide all that data retrospectively to you if you ask for it. So that's the big picture for me is giving people as much information as we can give them using my particular skill set, which happens to be optics and spectroscopy. How can we help a lot of people?
Okay. So you did mention at the start of this that the cost is reasonable. What are we talking? Approximate.
So under $200.
Oh, that is reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. And then per test, there's a per test cost of under $20.
So would you order like a kit of the like the testers?
Yeah, you get a starter kit, which has some of these that come with the base, you know, with the basic starter kit. And then you order replacements. So you can order these for under $20 a test whenever you need them. We don't know, honestly, how frequently people are going to want to measure. We've tried to survey people. I'd be curious your thoughts on this, actually.
Exactly, Bob, right now.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to know once a week.
Once a week.
Yeah. Once a week.
That's what I want to know too.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So you can buy these in quantity and get discounts on that price. You know, a lot of it is you know, is just labor associated with getting these to you. You know, if you're testing, once a week. Some people tell us that they only want to test once a month, and that's okay too. And I would say that's kind of a bare minimum for being able to see what is actually causing the changes. You know, you're going to want to know what you did that improved your result.
I agree.
Weekly is very, very smart.
I think, listen, I am a practitioner and I'm a nutritionist. And so a lot of times, you know, our health is not, it's fluid. It's always changing. And often we don't even know, like, okay, like 1 week. And this is why, you know, I don't know what to think about a lot of these microbiome tests because our microbiome is always changing and right. you eat a certain food and that could set off a trajectory that right. you could have gut issues just for a week. You know what I'm yeah. saying? So yeah. when you do tests weekly, you really get to see how what you're doing is affecting it. I personally think okay. weekly is so valid for yes. and actionable.
It's actionable, yeah. Different biomarkers, I think, are different.
Yeah.
So like glucose, you know, some people are having a lot of success with continuous glucose monitors, which give you, you know, minute by minute data because there's a postprandial change in glucose in your blood, you know, after you eat a meal. And, you know, there's diurnal changes also.
Yes.
So, you know, glucose is one where you, you know, you kind of want an intraday number. Inflammation is one where week to week is going to be the right cadence, I think.
I agree with you on that. So that's actually very reasonable. And where is it going to be available?
We're selling it right now just through our website, so corehealth.com. You know, there will be channel partners. You know, we think there will be practitioners who want to be able to offer it, you know, as part of their practice. You know, we're just starting out, so we don't have any of that built out yet. So the only way it's available at the moment is, it's not available at all. You can't get one shipped to you today.
Right.
It's available for the waiting list is open via our website, and that's how we'll be selling them for, for the near future.
And do you ship worldwide?
We're going to be able to, no, it's the initial approval is going to be an FDA approval. US, we have to get a different approval for Canada, really for any other country.
Okay.
But these are not, because of ESR being what it is, these are not lengthy approval processes. So
yeah.
I would expect to be able to ship to Canada very quickly.
And what about Europe?
Europe also quickly.
Yeah. Because it's like you said, ESR is a pretty standard, long-standing measurement. It's just ensuring that your device measures it correctly and accurately.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right?
It's just there are different rules in every different country. So we need, you know, we just need to make sure we play by the rules.
Yes, of course. And then, you know, I just thought of this. I thought, wow, how cool would this be even in your doctor's office?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And even in Canada, Canadians, like, don't you think it's worthwhile to pay the doctor's office $20 to find out right then and there, like, if there's something pretty high, like inflammatory going on in your body? Like, I think so, personally.
Or even, you know, more fitness-oriented businesses like gyms and things like relaxation techniques can lower inflammation. Mm. So massage and cryotherapy, things like that, those can lower inflammation.
Oh, yeah.
So, you could see putting the device, offering it as part of those sorts of services. Spa services also.
Very cool idea.
The Germans are big on, for example, on medical spas. So they do a lot. They have in Germany, if you can check into a 2-week treatment at a live-in, you know, resident spa. And they do a lot of blood testing already. So it would be a natural fit with that sort of thing. That's less popular in the U.S. I mean, there are things like Canyon Ranch, obviously, which, maybe could be a partner of ours someday.
Yeah, very cool. Bob, is there anything that we didn't cover off? I think we covered a ton in an hour. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I can't think of anything, Sandy. This was so much fun.
Yeah.
I just want to reiterate that people can go to our website, corehealth.com. We're not selling, but we can put your name on our waiting list. And, obviously we'll fill orders first come, first serve.
Yeah, this is a great things to come. Everyone, I suggest you check it out. Check my show notes. And thank you so, so much, Bob. It's a sheer pleasure meeting you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for all the great work you do.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to share it with someone you know might benefit. And always remember, when you rate, review, subscribe, you help to support my content and help me to keep going and bringing these conversations to you each and every week. Join me next week for a new topic, new guest, new exciting conversations to help you live your best life.